The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
Now, keeping the EU and incoming European states in mind, we're joined by a Dubliner who is in the final stages of pulling together an Irish festival in Belgrade. Jasch Kaminski, the son of a Polish Holocaust survivor who came to Ireland and became an Irish citizen, will host the Hothouse Flowers and Jim Sheridan in Belgrade as part of the festival. The festival is supported by the likes of Culture Ireland and companies such as CRH and Smurfit. Jasch, why an Irish festival in Belgrade? Are there many Irish people living there?
50. Only 50.
Yourself and 49, is it?
Myself and 49. But the thing is that what most people don't realise and what I didn't realise is that Belgrade is a Celtic city. It was founded by Celts. It was formerly known as Singi Dunham. And so you go there today and like Irish people and anywhere in the world, you get a very warm reception, not only because we're Irish and everything that goes with it, but because they have a Celtic connection and they kind of hearken back to that, and that's their history, that's their roots.
And is there much knowledge about Ireland appetite for it culturally in Serbia?
Absolutely. I mean, as you and as everybody knows, great Irish bands, great Irish poets, great Irish writers are worldwide brands and worldwide names.
So what kind of things do you cover in the festival? This year's programme, for example.
So this year's programme, we're opening with the Hothouse Flowers. And we also have a contemporary Irish band from County Wexford called the Wild Turkeys. And we'll be putting the Wild Turkeys in with a local Serbian gypsy band. And we're having an event called the Battle of the Bands for St. Patrick's Night. But that's music. So we also have a film programme, which is how the festival started. And this year we're very grateful that the Irish film director Jim Sheridan is coming to visit and open the film section.
Can you make money out of it? Is it a good business venture?
Mm. Well, one of my good friends said to me recently, he says, Jasch, he said, do you know how you make €1 million in culture? And I said, no. And he says to me, well, you spend €2 million. So it's difficult, but it is in the black. It's never.
You're not losing money.
You're not losing money. It washes its face and you end up with a few bob left in the account to start the following year's programme.
What's it like to live in Belgrade? What kind of a city is it?
It's a very exciting city. It reminds me, I'm from Dublin, but I actually went to university the second time in Cork, in UCC. It kind of reminds you what Cork is to Dublin. I find Belgrade is the rest of Europe. It's the kind of city you don't have to run very, very fast to stay still. So it reminds me of Dublin in the 80s. You know, you can't, a lot of the time you can't see the double yellow lines on the street, so you can still park there. You can still plead with the policeman, you know, and he'll probably let you go if you're, you know, caught jaywalking, as I was the other day.
And what about the Serbs themselves? Most people, I think, you know, who aren't familiar with it would associate Serbia. They think back to the Balkan Wars and the 1990s and everything that went on, and questions about war crimes, tribunals and investigations. Serbia has applied to join the EU and it's in this pre-accession phase, isn't it? But
There's
still a lot of question marks about governance, the judicial system, press freedom, human rights, all of these things.
What I'd say is this, is that the most people, like in Northern Ireland, if you like, most people are just ordinary people. And therefore, they're not, if you like, you know, culpable or involved in war crimes and things, the bad things that happened, if you like. Most people are ordinary middle class people who, in fact, it's a double whammy for local people, because not only were they kind of projected as the bogeymen in the international community, but domestically they all lost their jobs, they lost their savings, they lost their pensions, they lost their education system, they lost their health system, and they would have had one of the best. They weren't behind the Iron Curtain, but in the Eastern Bloc, and they weren't even in the Warsaw Pact, but they would have had the best sort of system in that sort of region. And they lost everything. So they were, if you like, they had double trouble. They got it from their own government, who robbed them, and if you like, abused them themselves. And they got it from the international community, who also, if you like, blamed them.
And what do they think of the EU? They're in this pre-accession. They're going to join. It's expected that they'll join in a few years' time. Do they like the EU? Are they worried about that? Suspicious of it?
I would say sceptical. They're sceptical. And it's unfortunate, because me as a young Irishman, well, no, I'm not so young anymore. Anyway, me as an Irishman, would see the benefits of, you know, growing up in the 70s, the 80s, and, you know, working and seeing the success of Ireland from the EU. So I'm very much, you know, a witness, an advocate of something like the European Union. But for them, they had a thing called the EU, which was called Yugoslavia, which was a federation of six states and two regions. They had, if you like, a federal system, and they lost everything. And so they lost it, and now they're being asked to join something. And many of the members of the European Union were also members of NATO. And of course, the city was bombed in 1999, and that's not easily forgotten, and the scars are
and that's remain. So great. When you're out and about and you're talking to Serbs, do you speak the language at this stage? Do you?
Preach a malo jezik, yeah.
I do. I presume that means yes, I do.
I speak a little badly. Serbian.
Has it been difficult to learn?
Yeah, it's a Slavic language. It is. Everyone says it's a different difficult language, but it's doable. Like many people learn other languages.
So when you're out and about in Belgrade and you're talking to Serbs, is there an element of don't mention the war, or is it something that crops up?
At this stage, I've learned. I mean, I'm very interested in politics. I'm very interested in history. And I like talking about things like this. But as a good friend of mine said to me, and I would get into conversations, but a good friend of mine said to me, he says, Yash, for these people, it was real. So it's for me, it's a kind of, you know, coffee conversation. But for them, their brothers, their sisters, their fathers, their mothers, they lost their society. Some cases, they lost family members. In many cases, they lost their homes. I mean, Belgrade, this is another thing, if you like, Belgrade wouldn't associate, but they lost, you know, millions of people lost their homes in Bosnia and in Kosovo. They all came to Serbia. And Serbia is a, you know, it's a dynamic country, but not easy to absorb millions of people, you know. So it brings with it social problems.
Now, in your own family background, you grew up in Dublin. Your dad, Jan Kaminski, was originally from Poland, and he fled during the Second World War, fled from the Nazis. What happened?
Well, he was born in 1932, so the war started in 1939. So he was 7 years, war broke out. He was born in what you could only describe as the very epicenter of hell, you know, between three different, you know, death camps, Belzec, Sobibor, or Treblinka, and Auschwitz. And he was Jewish. There's a record that shows that his town was liquidated in two dates in November 1942. And he said to me that there was a ghetto in the town, you know, a barbed wire open sort of prison, if you like. And because he had sort of fair hair and as a small child, he was able to sort of move in and out. So he simply, there was a, let's say, a commotion with shots and shouting and dogs barking. And this is what what the record would show and what he would say. And he just ran. He fled into the woods and changed his name to become a very Polish sounding name.
But he was on his own.
He was on his own, yeah. He was on his own, and he found a way of, he would work as a farmhand. He would stop, you know, he would mind a cow in a field, or he would get odd jobs, you know, on farms and so on. But he wouldn't stay longer than a day or two because feeling that someone might recognise, you know.
We have a clip here of your dad speaking during a TV documentary about survivors of the Holocaust living in Ireland. This is Jan Kaminski.
I tried to explain it to myself. I think really at the bottom of it all is a sense of guilt. Guilt because you have abandoned them. Maybe you have abandoned them. I know there is an easy explanation to rationalize that you have to save yourself. But the guilt is there. I still hope against all hope, because I've tried various venues, you know, to try and find out something or someone who might know something about them. My family, the way it was when we parted at the beginning of the war. So far, I haven't. But every time I'm talking about it, it does actually become a very strong emotional experience. And it's not changing. It's there to this day.
Did your dad talk about these events much when you were growing up?
No, not at all. He maintained his sort of his disguise throughout our childhood, so we never knew. It was only until I was about 18 years of age, and I myself was looking for my own, who I was, that I accidentally stumbled upon his Jewish roots. totally by accident. And he turned around to me on a Sunday afternoon and said to me, "You know I'm Jewish." And I said to him, "No." So.
And his family, he never, he wasn't able to trace what happened to his family. Were they all killed? Does he know that for a fact?
Well, again, I did, so from 1986 to 1999, I researched, if you like, his family and tried to find them, if you like, once I knew his real name. And I started looking in the archives, and luckily this coincided with the internet. So you're able to do a lot of research yourself with the 52K line, remember? One of those.
The dial-up.
Yeah. I spent years looking for them. I did find one family member, and it wasn't direct family. It was a kind of a cousin, if you like, a distant cousin. I'm correct in assuming that what you have to do is you have to, you look, when you're doing this research, you see that the Germans kept a record that they were going around this part of Poland liquidating villages, and his village was liquidated on two dates, November 2nd, I think, and 9th, 1942. So one has to assume.
They would round up the Jewish residents and just kill them all?
They were sent to a camp called Belzec in his area. And Belzec was simply a death camp. You arrived, you were sent down down a tunnel with sticks and straight into a gas chamber. So unlike, if you like, the stereotype, and it was hard for me to find them in a way because there's a stereotype of a Jewish person that we have. It's a sort of, you know, a Dutch sort of educated or French, you know, scientist or a philosopher or a psychologist or a doctor or a professor. But these were very just ordinary poor people. And they were hard. It was even harder because my own perception was clouded by this image. So I was looking for the great family, if you like. But in reality, I think they were very poor trading people. So I was looking in the wrong place.
Do you think your dad keeping from you for all those years until you were 18, what his whole story was and what had happened to him? Why do you think that was? Would he have found it very upsetting? Was he still fearful?
I think the latter, that something that, you know, I think what his history had taught him was that anything can happen at any time and you have to be prepared.
So he ended up coming to Ireland. After studying here, he stayed and set up businesses here.
Yeah, he went to school in Trinity. He'd already lived two or three lives, if you like, by the age he was 20. And suddenly he meets Ireland's elite in Trinity College, Dublin. He befriends them. He's already been very industrious in Trinity College. He's selling champagne outside of the Trinity Ball out of his VW van. He had to take chances, and he wasn't afraid to take chances. He'd seen a lot of bad things. So we bought a restaurant up on Ellis Quay. So there was an ad, apparently, he said in the paper that said restaurant for sale at any price. So we bought it. He borrowed £500 from his friend Nick McGillicuddy. And he bought the restaurant and opened up a late night diner, a steakhouse, where they used to serve, you know, white wine teapots and red wine and Coca-Cola bottles and steaks. But interestingly enough, I mean, he was a hardworking man. He had a job in ICL Computers, 9-to-5 salesman's job. And then from 11 o'clock at night to 5 in the morning, he'd run the last post. For 8 years he did that. So that was just, I mean, it was for him, it was an opportunity to, you know, to never to be poor again.
He would have been well known in Irish business circles through Concord Travel and flew. Was a travel agent and was in the charter business, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was very much a travel agency and a tour operation based in Lower Baggot Street, and then in Capel Street. And he was a kind of an innovative, like kind of almost like a Michael O'Leary before Michael O'Leary. He wanted to make value travel available to everybody. So he did exactly that. He did charter trips to Rome, to Paris, and he spotted out good opportunities. And a good example would be, you know, when, for example, when, let's say, the rugby game is on in Ireland and the French come to Dublin to play rugby. Well, my father in the 1970s realised that those planes were going back empty. So he negotiated the deal with the airlines to buy all those seats that the plane would have gone back empty at knockdown prices, like 20 euros a seat. So he could organise a weekend away in Paris for Irish people when the French were in Dublin. And it was very affordable. So, and then he also was involved in sort of, he was asked to research, look into travel to Medjugorje for Irish pilgrims in Bosnia in the 1980s. And again, because of his Eastern European and familiarity with the European environment, he very quickly identified the Yugoslav state operator as Yugotours, and they were able to provide him with planes in the kind of early part of the season, sort of Easter, and in the late part of the season, in the autumn. And then in the middle part of the season, he was able to introduce a new market called Yugoslavia, Croatia and Montenegro. And
so while you were growing up as a kid, that was all going on. Did you get to travel on any of these cheap flights to wherever it was?
Yeah, my father, he was the kind of guy we had to switch off the lights at home at night or be shouted at. So he hated waste. So he never let a seat go. So as kids, we spent our childhood, you know, in most European cities with his tours. And the interesting thing was that, you know, travel still hadn't evolved to the middle classes, if you like. It was only very, very wealthy people traveling. So having three kids in somewhere like Paris or Madrid or Rome wasn't an easy undertaking. So our parents used to literally, we were nine, myself and my two sisters, we were 8, 9 and 10, 10, 11 and 12. And my father used to, my mother, we'd meet them after breakfast in the reception of a city hotel. We'd be given the equivalent of £5 in the local currency. We'd be given the business card of the hotel, and we were told the Colosseum's that direction and be back here at 5 o'clock. And,
so off we go. You were on your own.
And my sister and myself, and when we were, my mother and my, one of my sisters were away in Spain, and I was nine. And myself and my sister had come back from some camp, like Rockwell or something like that. My father really didn't have the time or the energy to look after us. And he had a flight to Iceland, to Reykjavik, and he put myself and my sister on a plane alone with 100 quid at the age of 9 and 10 years of age. And off we went to Reykjavik for a week. My mother came home.
What did you do there?
Where are the children? And he said, they're in Iceland. And she said, they're what? And then he kind of later said, well, at least the Nazis aren't shooting at them. They'll be okay.
And he bought a hotel in Kilkee.
He bought a hotel in the west of Ireland that had gone bankrupt 5 times. It had been built by KLM and Bord Fáilte. And it was a total wreck, an eyesore and a social problem in this small village in the west coast. And he thought, you know, he could make a go. It was in a beautiful, he recognised it was on a beautiful beach. It was a very large, substantial 100-bedroom hotel. So we bought it and started to bring workers down from Dublin and from Limerick to renovate it. And eventually he opened a disco in it after a few years, and the disco rocked.
It took off.
There was no disco. I think one of the magic parts of the formula was that he wasn't from there. So he didn't employ, if you like, the local, you know, somebody's aunt or somebody's uncle or somebody's nephew. So people who came there felt free. It was a sort of, if you like, it was a social free environment. So people could kiss without, you know, feeling that their aunt was looking at them, you know.
And was he good at making the business work and doing it in a sort of on the cheap, cost effectively, because he was quite price conscious?
Yeah, he had to be. I mean, a 100-bedroom hotel in the west of Ireland, you know, that opened for 3 months, six weeks a year, had to be run in a very carefully, or you just wouldn't be in business. So people like the state tourism authority were hoping, you know, were trying to get him to invest millions in it, but he knew he wouldn't be there the following year.
For you then, growing up with your dad involved in all these different businesses and being exposed to foreign cities, to different kinds of businesses and all that, were you always a bit entrepreneurial? Or?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think actually I didn't want to. I wanted to do something different. I worked as a reporter, but because of my business background, I did always end up magnetizing or gravitating towards business because I probably understood it well. So, I mean, the things that I learned from my father were always have an option, always be, you know, be ready for change, never expect things can change at any time, if you like. So something like the Belgrade Irish Festival is a very good example of, you know, thinking outside the box, doing something that isn't really that obvious, but it's obviously has some, sustainability.
Well, Yash Kaminski, good luck with the festival, and thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thanks a million, Richard.